The professional blows critics off. He doesn't even hear them. Critics, he reminds himself, are the unwitting mouthpieces of resistance, and as such can be truly cunning and pernicious. They can articulate in their reviews the same toxic venom that resistance itself concocts inside our heads. That is their real evil, not that we believe them, but that we believe the resistance in our own minds, for which critics serve as unconscious spokespersons. The professional learns to recognize envy-driven criticism and to take it for what it is, the supreme compliment. The critic hates most that which he would have done himself if he had had the guts. A professional recognizes her limitations. She gets an agent, she gets a lawyer, she gets an accountant. She knows she can only be a professional at one thing. She brings in other pros and treats them with respect. A professional reinvents himself. Goldie Hawn once observed that there are only three ages for an actress in Hollywood: Babe, D.A., and Driving Miss Daisy. She was making a different point, but the truth remains. As artists, we serve the muse. And the muse may have more than one job for us over our lifetime. The professional does not permit himself to become hidebound within one incarnation, however comfortable or successful. Like a transmigrating soul, he shucks his outworn body and dons a new one. He continues his journey. A professional is recognized by other professionals. The professional senses who has served his time and who hasn't. Like Alan Ladd and Jack Palance circling each other in Shane. A gun recognizes another gun. You, Incorporated. When I first moved to Los Angeles and made the acquaintance of working screenwriters, I learned that many had their own corporations. They provided their writing services not as themselves, but as loan-outs from their one-man businesses. Their writing contracts were FSO, for services of themselves. I had never seen this before. I thought it was pretty cool. For a writer to incorporate himself has certain tax and financial advantages, but what I love about it is the metaphor. I like the idea of being myself incorporated. That way I can wear two hats. I can hire myself and fire myself. I can even, as Robin Williams once remarked of writer-producers, blow smoke up my own ass. Making yourself a corporation, or just thinking of yourself in that way, reinforces the idea of professionalism because it separates the artist doing the work from the will and consciousness running the show. No matter how much abuse is heaped on the head of the former, the latter takes it in stride and keeps on trucking. Conversely with success, you, the writer, may get a swelled head, but you, the boss, remember how to take yourself down a peg. Have you ever worked in an office? Then you know about Monday morning status meetings. The group assembles in the conference room, and the boss goes over what assignments each team member is responsible for in the coming week. When the meeting breaks up, an assistant prepares a worksheet and distributes it. When this hits your desk an hour later, you know exactly what you have to do that week. I have one of those meetings with myself every Monday. I sit down and go over my assignments. Then I type it up and distribute it to myself. I have corporate stationery and corporate business cards and a corporate checkbook. I write off corporate expenses and pay corporate taxes. I have different credit cards for myself and my corporation. If we think of ourselves as a corporation, it gives us a healthy distance on ourselves. We're less subjective. We don't take blows as personally. We're more cold-blooded. We can price our wares more realistically. Sometimes, as Joe Blow himself, I'm too mild-mannered to go out and sell. But as Joe Blow Incorporated, I can pimp the hell out of myself. I'm not me anymore. I'm me incorporated. I'm a pro. A critter that keeps coming. Why does resistance yield to our turning pro? Because resistance is a bully, Resistance has no strength of its own. Its power derives entirely from our fear of it. A bully will back down before the runtiest twerp who stands his ground. The essence of professionalism is the focus upon the work and its demands while we are doing it, to the exclusion of all else. The ancient Spartans schooled themselves to regard the enemy, any enemy, as nameless and faceless. In other words, they believed that if they did their work, no force on earth could stand against them. In The Searchers, John Wayne and Jeffrey Hunter pursue the war chief, Scar, who has kidnapped their young kinswoman, played by Natalie Wood. Winter stops them, but Wayne's character, Ethan Edwards, does not slacken his resolve. He'll return to the trail in spring, he declares, and sooner or later, the fugitive's vigilance will slacken. Ethan, seems he never learns there's such a thing as a critter that might just keep coming on. So we'll find him in the end, I promise you that. Just as sure as the turning of the earth. The pro keeps coming on. He beats resistance at its own game by being even more resolute and even more implacable than it is. No mystery. There's no mystery to turning pro. It's a decision brought about by an act of will. We make up our mind to view ourselves as pros, and we do it. Simple as that. Book 3. Beyond Resistance. The Higher Realm. The first duty is to sacrifice to the gods and pray them to grant you the thoughts, words, and deeds likely to render your command most pleasing to the gods, and to bring yourself, your friends, and your city the fullest measure of affection and glory and advantage. Xenophon, the cavalry commander. Angels in the Abstract. The next few chapters are going to be about those invisible psychic forces that support and sustain us in our journey toward ourselves. I plan on using terms like muses and angels. Does that make you uncomfortable? If it does, you have my permission to think of angels in the abstract. Consider these forces as being impersonal as gravity. Maybe they are. It's not hard to believe, is it, that a force exists in every grain and seed to make it grow? Or that in every kitten or colt is an instinct that impels it to run and play and learn. Just as resistance can be thought of as personal, I've said resistance loves such and such or hates such and such, it can also be viewed as a force of nature as impersonal as entropy or molecular decay. Similarly, the call to growth can be conceptualized as personal, a daimon or genius, an angel or a muse, or as impersonal, like the tides or the transiting of Venus. Either way works, as long as we're comfortable with it. Or, if extra dimensionality doesn't sit well with you in any form, think of it as talent, programmed into our genes by evolution. The point for the thesis I'm seeking to put forward is that there are forces we can call our allies. As resistance works to keep us from becoming who we were born to be, equal and opposite powers are counterpoised against it. These are our allies and angels. Approaching the mystery. Why have I stressed professionalism so heavily in the preceding chapters? Because the most important thing about art is to work. Nothing else matters except sitting down every day and trying. Why is this so important? Because when we sit down day after day and keep grinding, something mysterious starts to happen. A process is set into motion by which, inevitably and infallibly, heaven comes to our aid. Unseen forces enlist in our cause. Serendipity reinforces our purpose. This is the other secret that real artists know and wannabe writers don't. When we sit down each day and do our work, power concentrates around us. The muse takes note of our dedication. She approves. We have earned favor in her sight. When we sit down and work, we become like a magnetized rod that attracts iron filings. Ideas come, insights accrete. Just as resistance has its seat in hell, so creation has its home in heaven. And it's not just a witness, but an eager and active ally. What I call professionalism, someone else might call the artist's code or the warrior's way. It's an attitude of egolessness and service. The Knights of the Round Table were chaste and self-effacing, yet they dueled dragons. We're facing dragons, too. Fire-breathing griffins of the soul, whom we must outfight and outwit to reach the treasure of our self in potential, and to release the maiden who is God's plan and destiny for ourselves, and the answer to why we were put on this planet. Invoking the Muse. The quote from Xenophon that opens this section comes from a pamphlet called The Cavalry Commander, in which the celebrated warrior and historian proffers instruction to those young gentlemen who aspire to be officers of the Athenian Equestrian Corps. He declares that the commander's first duty, before he mucks out a stable or seeks funding from the Defense Review Board, is to sacrifice to the gods and invoke their aid. I do the same thing. The last thing I do before I sit down to work is say my prayer to the muse. I say it out loud in absolute earnest. Only then do I get down to business. In my late 20s, I rented a little house in Northern California. I had gone there to finish a novel or kill myself trying. By that time, I had blown up a marriage to a girl I loved with all my heart, screwed up two careers, blah, blah, etc., all because, though I had no understanding of this at the time, I could not handle resistance. I had one novel 9/10 of the way through and another at 99/100 before I threw them in the trash. I couldn't finish them. I didn't have the guts. In yielding thusly to resistance, I fell prey to every vice, evil, distraction, you name it, mentioned heretofore, all leading nowhere, and finally washed up in this sleepy California town with my Chevy van, my cat Mo, and my antique Smith Corona. A guy named Paul Rink lived down the street. Look him up. He's in Henry Miller's Big Sur and the Oranges of Hieronymus Bosch. Paul was a writer. He lived in his camper, Moby Dick. I started each day over coffee with Paul. He turned me on to all kinds of authors I had never heard of, lectured me on self-discipline, dedication, the evils of the marketplace. But best of all, he shared with me his prayer, the invocation of the muse from Homer's Odyssey, the T.E. Lawrence translation. Paul typed it out for me on his even more ancient than mine Manuel Remington. I still have it. It's yellow and parched as dust. The merest puff would blow it to powder. In my little house, I had no TV. I never read a newspaper or went to a movie. I just worked. One afternoon, I was banging away in the little bedroom I had converted to an office, when I heard my neighbor's radio playing outside. Someone in a loud voice was declaiming, "To preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States." I came out. "What's going on? Didn't you hear? Nixon's out. They got a new guy in there." I had missed Watergate completely. I was determined to keep working. I had failed so many times and caused myself and people I loved so much pain thereby that I felt if I crapped out this time, I would have to hang myself. I didn't know what resistance was then. No one had schooled me in the concept. I felt it, though, big time. I experienced it as a compulsion to self-destruct. I could not finish what I started. The closer I got, the more different ways I'd find to screw it up. I worked for 26 months straight, taking only two out for a stint of migrant labor in Washington State, and finally, one day, I got to the last page and typed out, "The End." I never did find a buyer for the book, or the next one either. It was 10 years before I got the first check for something I had written, and 10 more before a novel, The Legend of Bagger Vance, was actually published. But that moment when I first hit the keys to spell out "The End" was epical. I remember rolling the last page out and adding it to the stack that was the finished manuscript. Nobody knew I was done, nobody cared, but I knew. I felt like a dragon I'd been fighting all my life had just dropped dead at my feet and gasped out its last sulfuric breath. Rest in peace, motherfucker. Next morning, I went over to Paul's for coffee and told him I had finished. Good for you, he said, without looking up. Start the next one today. Invoking the Muse, Part 2. Before I met Paul, I had never heard of the Muses. He enlightened me. The Muses were 9 sisters, daughters of Zeus and Mnemosyne, which means memory. Their names are Clio, Erato, Thalia, Terpsichore, Calliope, Polyhymnia, Euterpe, Melpomene, and Urania. Their job is to inspire artists. Each muse is responsible for a different art. There's a neighborhood in New Orleans where the streets are named after the muses. I lived there once and had no idea. I thought they were just weird names. Here's Socrates, in Plato's Phaedrus, on the noble effect of heaven-sent madness. The third type of possession and madness is possession by the muses. When this seizes upon a gentle and virgin soul, it rouses it to inspired expression in lyric and other sorts of poetry, and glorifies countless deeds of the heroes of old for the instruction of posterity. But if a man comes to the door of poetry untouched by the madness of the muses, believing that technique alone will make him a good poet, he and his sane compositions never reach perfection, but are utterly eclipsed by the performances of the inspired madman. The Greek way of apprehending the mystery was to personify it. The ancients sensed powerful primordial forces in the world. To make them approachable, they gave them human faces. They called them Zeus, Apollo, Aphrodite. American Indians felt the same mystery but rendered it in animistic forms: bear teacher, hawk messenger, coyote trickster. Our ancestors were keenly cognizant of forces and energies whose seat was not in this material sphere but in a loftier, more mysterious one. What did they believe about this higher reality? First, they believed that death did not exist there. The gods are immortal. The gods, though not unlike humans, are infinitely more powerful. To defy their will is futile. To act toward heaven with pride is to call down calamity. Time and space display an altered existence in this higher dimension. The gods travel swift as thought. They can tell the future, some of them. And though the playwright Agathon tells us this alone is denied to God, the power to undo the past, yet the immortals can play tricks with time, as we ourselves may sometimes in dreams or visions. The universe, the Greeks believed, was not indifferent. The gods take an interest in human affairs and intercede for good or ill in our designs. The contemporary view is that all this is charming, but preposterous. Is it? Then answer this. Where did Hamlet come from? Where did the Parthenon come from? Where did nude descending a staircase come from?
This ends Disc 2. The War of Art, Disc 3.
Testament of a Visionary. Eternity is in love with the creations of time. William Blake. The visionary poet, William Blake, was, so I understand, one of those half-mad avatars who appear in flesh from time to time, savants capable of ascending for brief periods to loftier planes and returning to share the wonders they have seen. Shall we try to decipher the meaning of the verse above? What Blake means by eternity, I think, is the sphere higher than this one, a plane of reality superior to the material dimension in which we dwell. In eternity, there is no such thing as time. or Blake's syntax wouldn't distinguish it from eternity, and probably no space either. This plane may be inhabited by higher creatures, or it may be pure consciousness or spirit. But whatever it is, according to Blake, it's capable of being in love. If beings inhabit this plane, I take Blake to mean that they are incorporeal. They don't have bodies. But they have a connection to the sphere of time, the one we live in. These gods or spirits participate in this dimension. They take an interest in it. Eternity is in love with the creations of time means, to me, that in some way these creatures of the higher sphere, or the sphere itself in the abstract, take joy in what we time-bound beings can bring forth into physical existence in our limited material sphere. It may be pushing the envelope, but if these beings take joy in the creations of time, might they not also nudge us a little to produce them? If that's true, then the image of the muse whispering inspiration in the artist's ear is quite apt. The timeless communicating to the time-bound. By Blake's model, as I understand it, it's as though the Fifth Symphony existed already in that higher sphere before Beethoven sat down and played da-da-da-dum. The catch was this. The work existed only as potential, without a body, so to speak. It wasn't music yet. You couldn't play it. You couldn't hear it. It needed someone. It needed a corporeal being, a human, an artist, or more precisely, a genius in the Latin sense of soul or animating spirit, to bring it into being on this material plane. So the muse whispered in Beethoven's ear. Maybe she hummed a few bars into a million other ears, but no one else heard her. Only Beethoven got it. He brought it forth. He made the Fifth Symphony a creation of time, which eternity could be in love with. So that eternity, whether we conceive of it as God, pure consciousness, infinite intelligence, omniscient spirit, or if we choose to think of it as beings, gods, spirits, avatars, when it or they hear somehow the sounds of earthly music, it brings them joy. In other words, Blake agrees with the Greeks. The gods do exist. They do penetrate our earthly sphere. Which brings us back to the muse. The muse, remember, is the daughter of Zeus, father of the gods, and memory, mnemosyne. That's a pretty impressive pedigree. I'll accept those credentials. I'll take Xenophon at his word. Before I sit down to work, I'll take a minute and show respect to this unseen power who can make or break me. Invoking the Muse, Part 3. Artists have invoked the muse since time immemorial. There is great wisdom to this. There is magic to effacing our human arrogance and humbly entreating help from a source we cannot see, hear, touch, or smell. Here's the start of Homer's Odyssey, the T.E. Lawrence translation. O divine poesy, goddess, daughter of Zeus, sustain for me this song of the various-minded man who, after he had plundered the innermost citadel of hallowed Troy, was made to stray grievously about the coasts of men, the sport of their customs, good and bad, while his heart, through all the seafaring, ached with an agony to redeem himself and bring his company safe home. Vain hope for them, the fools, their own witlessness cast them aside. To destroy for meat the oxen of the most exalted sun, wherefore the sun god blotted out the day of their return. Make this tale live for us in all its many bearings, O muse. This passage will reward closer study. First, divine poesy. When we invoke the muse, we are calling on a force not just from a different plane of reality, but from a holier plane. Goddess, daughter of Zeus, not only are we invoking divine intercession, but intercession on the highest level, just one remove from the top. Sustain for me. Homer doesn't ask for brilliance or success. He just wants to keep this thing going. this song. That about covers it, from the Brothers Karamazov to your new venture in the plumbing supply business. I love the summation of Odysseus's trials that comprises the body of the invocation. It's Joseph Campbell's hero's journey in a nutshell, as concise a synopsis of the story of every man as it gets. There's the initial crime, which we all inevitably commit, which ejects the hero from his homebound complacency and propels him upon his wanderings, the yearning for redemption, the untiring campaign to get home, meaning back to God's grace, back to himself. I admire particularly the warning against the second crime, to destroy for meat the oxen of the most exalted son. That's the felony that calls down soul destruction, the employment of the sacred for profane means. Prostitution. Selling out. Lastly, the artist's wish for his work. Make this tale live for us in all its many bearings, O Muse. That's what we want, isn't it? More than make it great, make it live. And not from one angle only, but in all its many bearings. Okay, we've said our prayer. We're ready to work. Now what? The magic of making a start. Concerning all acts of initiative and creation, there is one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans. That the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would not otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision, raising in one's favor all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance which no man would have dreamed would come his way. I have learned a deep respect for one of Goethe's couplets. Whatever you can do, or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, magic, and power in it. Begin it now. W. H. Murray, The Scottish Himalayan Expedition. Did you ever see Wings of Desire, Wim Wenders' film about angels among us? City of Angels with Meg Ryan and Nicolas Cage was the American version. I believe it. I believe there are angels. They're here, but we can't see them. Angels work for God. It's their job to help us, wake us up, bump us along. Angels are agents of evolution. The Kabbalah describes angels as bundles of light, meaning intelligence, consciousness. Kabbalists believe that above every blade of grass is an angel crying, "Grow, grow." I'll go further. I believe that above the entire human race is one super angel crying, "Evolve, evolve." Angels are like muses. They know stuff we don't. They want to help us. They're on the other side of a pane of glass, shouting to get our attention, but we can't hear them. We're too distracted by our own nonsense. Ah, but when we begin, when we make a start, when we conceive an enterprise and commit to it in the face of our fears, something wonderful happens. A crack appears in the membrane, like the first craze when a chick pecks at the inside of its shell. Angel midwives congregate around us. They assist as we give birth to ourselves, to that person we were born to be, to the one whose destiny was encoded in our soul, our daimon, our genius. When we make a beginning, we get out of our own way and allow the angels to come in and do their job. They can speak to us now, and it makes them happy. It makes God happy. Eternity, as Blake might have told us, has opened a portal into time. And we're it. The magic of keeping going. When I finish a day's work, I head up into the hills for a hike. I take a pocket tape recorder because I know that as my surface mind empties with the walk, another part of me will chime in and start talking. The word Lear on page 342, it should be Ogle. You repeated yourself in chapter 21. The last sentence is just like that one in the middle of chapter 7. That's the kind of stuff that comes. It comes to all of us, every day, every minute. These paragraphs I'm writing now were dictated to me yesterday. They replace a prior, weaker opening to this chapter. I'm unspooling the new, improved version now, right off the recorder. This process of self-revision and self-correction is so common we don't even notice, but it's a miracle. And its implications are staggering. Who's doing this revising anyway? What force is yanking in our sleeves? What does it tell us about the architecture of our psyches, that without our exerting effort or even thinking about it, some voice in our head pipes up to counsel us, and counsel us wisely, on how to do our work and live our lives? Whose voice is it? What software is grinding away, scanning gigabytes, while we, our mainstream selves, are otherwise occupied? Are these angels? Are they muses? Is this the unconscious? The self? Whatever it is, it's smarter than we are. A lot smarter. It doesn't need us to tell it what to do. It goes to work all by itself. It seems to want to work. It seems to enjoy it. What exactly is it doing? It's organizing. The principle of organization is built into nature. Chaos itself is self-organizing. Out of primordial disorder, stars find their orbits. Rivers make their way to the sea. When we, like God, set out to create a universe, a book, an opera, a new business venture, the same principle kicks in. Our screenplay resolves itself into a three-act structure. Our symphony takes shape into movements. Our plumbing supply venture discovers its optimum chain of command. How do we experience this? By having ideas. Insights pop into our heads while we're shaving or taking a shower, or even, amazingly, while we're actually working. The elves behind this are smart. If we forget something, they remind us. If we veer off course, they trim the tabs and steer us back. What can we conclude from this? Clearly, some intelligence is at work, independent of our conscious mind and yet in alliance with it, processing our material for us and alongside us. This is why artists are modest. They know they're not doing the work, they're just taking dictation. It's also why non-creative people hate creative people, because they're jealous. They sense that artists and writers are tapped into some grid of energy and inspiration that they themselves cannot connect with. Of course, this is nonsense. We're all creative. We all have the same psyche. The same everyday miracles are happening in all our heads, day by day, minute by minute.